Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, everyone. I'm Siri Vaith, Executive Director of CFRI, and I welcome you to our CF Community Voices podcast series, what promises to be a very informative webinar on CF and ototoxicity, which impacts many people with CF and can have a significant impact upon quality of life and health. We're very fortunate to have three presenters with us today, Dr. Amit Euler, Dr. Angela Garinis, and Dr. Michael Dewing. There's a great deal of information to share, and so this webinar will be divided into two parts. In this, part one, we'll learn about the pathogenesis of CF and hearing loss, the causes of and screening for ototoxicity, and in part two, we will cover ototoxicity screening and prevention, its management, and future treatments and clinical trials. Before we get started, I do need to stress the information presented in this webinar is not to be used for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and to please consult with your medical team before making any changes to your healthcare regimen. I want to thank our sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Viatris, Genentech, and Chiesi USA. Thank you so much for your support of this program. Questions are being asked throughout this presentation in the Q&A box, and our panelists are responding as we go. And for those viewing this as a recording, these questions and answers are being saved and can be viewed by clicking on the Show More link on this YouTube page. And now, on to the substance. It is my honor to introduce our three panelists today. Dr. Amit Euler is a pulmonologist and the director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Program at Boston Children's Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Angela Garinis is an audiologist at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. And Dr. Michael Dewing is an audiologist at the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida. He's also an adult with CF. Welcome to all three of you, and thank you for sharing your time, expertise, and experience with us. I'll let you take it from here.
Thank you so much, Siri. Thank you for the invitation. I know Angie, Mike, and I are just really delighted to be here today to talk about a topic we're extremely interested in. We think that the community needs to know more about and be more educated on this topic. So thank you so much for this opportunity. Our brief overview, it's going to be a very brief pathogenesis of CF for those who are new to CF and joining us for the first time on this topic. And then we'll talk about the pathogenesis of hearing loss and battery of audiology tests, the current ototoxicity monitoring in CF centers or lack thereof, and prevalence of hearing, and screening and prevention, management of ototoxicity, and future treatments and clinical trials in progress. And then we hope to take your questions. And I'm sorry about that, but I'm not sure how I neglected this part, but we are joined by Michael Dewing, and as you mentioned, is a person with CF and a clinical audiologist, so he's an expert in this field as well. These are our disclosures, and this is going to be a lot of back and forth between us, and so hopefully this will be an engaging conversation for all of you to listen to. But pathogenesis of CF in brief. This is going to be the last time I use this word, but there's an abnormal gene on chromosome 7 called the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator gene, or CFTR. See, we barely ever use that anymore. We just say CFTR. But it codes for a transmembrane protein or an ion channel, which leads to either no protein being produced, an abnormally folded protein discarded by the cell, or a malfunctioning protein at the cell surface, at the apical membrane of some cells that are lined, essentially many of the tubes and in our body, just to put it simply. Chloride and bicarbonate, those are the two electrolytes that are really in concern here. And along with that, water can move freely, across the membrane. And in the airway, this causes mucus secretion to be thickened, and this airway surface liquid layer, a small liquid layer that overlies the lung epithelium that just doesn't function as well when it's dehydrated and these chlorides, the chloride and bicarbonate are not present. There is some great, lots of great therapies and research happening, trying to fix the gene and, and also help the protein function better. We're not going to get into that, but essentially, not everyone has such therapies available to them. And even for those who do, they can still lead to infection, inflammation in the airway that then leads ultimately to potentially to the destruction of the lungs and leading to need for a lung transplant. Now, I mentioned that CFTR is present in really like all the organs in our system. And so it really leads to a multi-organ involvement, although lung disease and the reason why pulmonologists are at the forefront of CF is because the lung disease is what causes the major morbidity mortality. But we can, as you know, the sweat glands can be impacted, and that's how we diagnose people with CF, the sinuses, the lungs, the pancreas, including not just for malabsorption, but diabetes, and the GI tract can be impacted and cause bowel obstruction, as well as the reproductive system. But it doesn't end there. It also can infect the liver, impact the liver and cause liver failure in 5% of folks and some people who need liver transplant before their lung disease progresses. And there can be issues with the gallbladder, bone disease, not just CFTR is expressed in bone, that can affect bone microarchitecture, but it can also be impacted by use of steroids, malnutrition, and just inflammation in general. You can develop pulmonary hypertension if lung disease progresses, without treatment. And also you can have an enlarged spleen and have infarcts in your spleen as resulting from the disease as well. We know that salivary glands can be impacted. You can have salivary stones and this can cause the mouth to be dry and other secretions to be dry as well. There is a increased prevalence of something called Arnold-Chiari malformation. And this is either direct through brain development or indirect, but this is only a small correlation. And then there's also the mental health aspects of anxiety and depression that we see in CF. And then there's some indirect and maybe direct effect of CFTR, but indirect in the way that some of our medications can cause toxicity, especially to the kidney, and why we're here today with hearing. So Angie, I don't know if you can share with us, some of the problems we see with hearing when we age.
Thank you, Amit. And thank you again, Siri, for inviting us. We're excited to do this talk. So age-related hearing loss is extremely common. I think most of us know someone, whether we have a grandparent or a parent with hearing loss. We know that statistically, about 1 in 3 individuals between the ages of 65 and 74 will have hearing loss. And once you hit the age of 75, your chances for hearing loss are about over 50%. Latest data is showing that there's a number of factors that can contribute to age-related hearing loss. And we typically use the term presbycusis to describe this. There could be 3 main types of presbycusis. They could be sensory, which is the most common. And so we'll talk a little bit about the ear later, but within the inner ear, there's a little picture here. So we have an inner ear that's lined with sensory cells. And those sensory cells, as we age, tend to degrade or we lose a portion of them. And you end up with a higher pitch or higher frequency hearing loss. This is the most common type of sensory loss that creates presbycusis. And it typically occurs in both ears around the same time. Another possible feature of presbycusis could be a metabolic issue where some of the structures of the inner ear are not producing the right amount of fluid that's supposed to bathe those sensory cells. And then a third could be neural, where you actually have damage to the nerve above the inner ear. And so the fibers of the nerve actually degrade. And so age-related hearing loss is very common and we do see it frequently. So noise is also extremely common, and noise-related hearing loss, we tend to see in a specific region of the inner ear. There's a sensitive region that you can actually lose hearing. So when we're testing someone, we kind of look for that as audiologists. Noise can occur from a lot of different sources. If we go to the next slide, let's see here. So one of the sources we typically talk about is impulse exposure. So from gunshots or from a different source where you're around noise for a long period of time, like being in a concert near the speaker for hours on end. These can be different features or external sources of creating a noise-induced hearing loss. And so Amit, I know, has a study he wants to share specifically related to this.
Right. So we conducted a survey-based study at our center, and it was we 44 subjects were enrolled between the ages of 13 and 48. It was a 26-item questionnaire with self-reported music listening behavior and attitudes towards music-induced hearing loss susceptibility, severity, benefits of preventing, and self-efficacy for preventing, preventative action. Now, we had, we had been interested in this for some time, especially as we saw people with CF as they're in the hospital getting medications, as that we're going to talk about, that are toxic to the ear. And we knew that listening to noise, especially, with the advent of the iPod back in the early 2000s, that kind of, second insult would be potentially extremely harmful to our patients. And so here we see some of the demographics, but what we, based on some previously validated dosimetry measures, we were able to look at percent noise dose, or I'm gonna put it in my few slides, ND percent, noise dose percent, and chosen listening level. And so these, from previously validated measures, we were able to tell from the questionnaire exactly the dosage that patients were getting. Here we look at the demographics, including the distribution of the patients and also their CFTR mutation, which also corresponds with our center. Here we look at the number of hospitalizations over the past 5 years and the number of courses of tobramycin specifically over the last 5 years. And as you can see, there is an array of patients with a number of hospitalizations and courses, but you can see that there's at least 20 people who had hospitalizations 11 times or more, and then, or 4+ courses of tobramycin. So these patients that we ask these questions to, I mean, they are a biased group. They're hospitalized getting antibiotics at the time, not all of them with tobramycin or immunoglycosides, but this is a group that is at risk. So the questionnaire results revealed a number of concerning findings, including, as you can see here, a number of our patients already had trouble hearing, and some reported having ear infection, but ringing in the ears is something I wanted to highlight, or tinnitus, and Angie and Michael will speak to this later, but 41% of these patients described having ringing in the ears at some point. And that is a question that we've found as we're doing this research, that as providers, we don't ask that question enough. And so we have a review of systems that we go through, and tinnitus sometimes gets missed. And then we also assess the audiologic status of participants. So this is called a three frequency pure tone average, essentially taking the average of their pure tone average at three different frequencies and averaging it out. And here we saw that, a decent number, 17 patients had no hearing loss, but then we had a number of other patients described from mild to severe hearing loss in this group. And essentially the study results really show that, patients believe that, hearing loss would be disruptive to their quality of life. That they were exposed using their MP3 player, using their iPod and listening to MP3 music, that their daily noise dose percent was 237%, so much greater than the 100% that they should be getting in a day, and weekly was at 173%. I mean, that their chosen listening level was also greater than 80 decibels, and something Angie will talk to in a moment, that really puts them at risk for music-induced hearing loss, but especially concerning when these are patients who are at increased risk getting immunoglycosides, and that noise exposures were high for a significant portion of this population. We know that CF patients with hearing loss reported believing that they're more susceptible, But interestingly, even though they perceived the benefits and believe they can prevent it, they also did not see themselves as susceptible. So this is also, you know, maybe skewing more towards adolescent and younger patients. But even though they knew this was high risk, they didn't perceive themselves to be at risk, even though they were engaging in high risk noise behavior. And then, so we know in this population, both ototoxicity prevalence and noise exposure is high, and that this topic is needs more study.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about this amazing program that was developed here at Oregon Hearing Research Center by Billy Martin and also Diana Menke, I believe. Their mission was to reduce the prevalence of noise-induced hearing loss and tinnitus by using a series of educational resources, research studies, and also exhibits in the community where they provide demonstrations on what is too loud for your hearing. I've provided the website here if anyone's interested. It still has a lot of information, although I think the programs are currently halted in terms of if they're using those educational courses. But one thing I wanted to show on the left here, you'll see a figure that talks about the safe versus dangerous decibel levels. And this is something that patients usually ask me about, what is too loud? Most of our iPods and our electronic devices can go to levels that can be dangerous for your hearing. And so if you look at this figure here, you'll see at the very lowest level, you have what we call 10 dB. So this is an sound pressure level, which is relevant to the human ear's audible sound. And the sound pressure level can range from the lowest volume or sound that we can hear up to the very highest painful hearing sensation. And because the values are astronomically large, we use this scale called a decibel scale to make them work, the numbers workable. And so it's a logarithmic scale, and this would be considered 10 decibels, 10 dB SPL, and that's considered normal breathing. So a very, very quiet sound up to the highest volume at about 150 dB decibels, which would be a firecracker going off near your head, and even further up where a rocket would be launching. So the further up on the graph that you see the levels rising, the more at risk you are for a noise-induced hearing loss if you continue to be exposed to those levels. And a really safe cutoff is at about 85 dB. So if we look on this graph, we see at 80 dB is about a blender or an alarm clock. And so around that level, you can listen to that for a long period of time and feel like you're in a relatively safe volume zone. The figure to the right here shows a really important component about the decibel level, so the level of the volume, and also the amount of time you're exposed to that volume. So if it's a louder sound, you have a limited amount of time to be exposed to it before it can cause hearing damage. So at the very bottom of this graph, you'll see 115 decibels, which is similar to maybe a rock concert, or even slightly higher would be like a gunshot going off near your head if you're a hunter. And so you can have a pretty dramatic noise exposed damage to your hearing system at that level, greater than 30 seconds. And then in general occupational noise, if you're exposed to 85 decibels, so at the very top for a continuous 8-hour period, if you go greater than 8 hours, you're at a higher risk for noise exposure. So the purpose of this slide is to say it's not just about the volume, it's also about the amount of time that you're exposed to that sound. And so I would refer back to the Dangerous Decibels website for more educational information about what is too loud.
And one other thing that I would add is that on your iPhone, there is a all health, if you look at that under health, you can look into there. And then actually, if you look at all health data, there's a section that shows you the decibel level that you've been listening to music on your earbuds. So it's something that you can track that as well. I'm not sure
if I could jump in here real quick.
Yeah.
Angie mentioned that this scale on the left is a logarithmic scale. And that means it's not linear. So the difference between, say, a babbling brook and a refrigerator, it's 10 dB. But the difference between a subway train and a motorcycle is not just 10, it's not one babbling brook louder, right? It's it's multiple times louder. So as you increase up the scale, it's increasing as a factor multiple times as loud to give you a sense of the scale of the sound.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That's a great clarification. One other thing I wanted to add about this. So when we talk about measuring noise over a continuous period of time, we can use a device called a dosimeter. And dosimeters, you can actually, OSHA uses this regularly to monitor work noise. So in a construction environment or a place where, say, an employee is exposed to really loud sounds, you can wear that dosimeter for an entire 24-hour period or throughout your workday, and it will calculate a dose of the noise exposure. And it can also filter that sound to be similar to show you what the peak levels are of noise that you're exposed throughout the day, and also the average level that you're exposed to throughout the day, which kind of replicates the filtering of the human ear. So those dosimeters are really useful. I'm just briefly going to say one of my first research projects, I was a master's student my first year, and I was actually paid to wear a dosimeter to go see concerts. So they paid for my concert tickets. I wore a dosimeter. I got into a ton of free shows, and we actually published that paper. I think it was pretty amazing.
What a great side benefit.
Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit just about genetics and hearing loss. As we know that a lot of genetic factors can be passed down from parents to their children. And so we do receive chromosomes and genes from our parents. Genetic mutations can occur within a change in the DNA sequence that's comprised within that gene. And that can cause a difference in the way that the gene actually functions. And so these mutations can be dominant or recessive depending on how they run in families. So in this example here, we're actually looking at an autosomal recessive inheritance. So you have two parents, you have the mother, female, and then the father, male. And the mother provides a chromosome to one of the children, which is a female, an X chromosome, and then the father is providing the other X. And so you get a pair of chromosomes for each child. And in this case, they have four children, and the one with the mutation, you can see here that is illustrated by the red line, is provided by the mother to one of the female children, and then also by the mother to the male child. And because they're a carrier, you have a 25% chance of your child who receives the mutation actually having some type of a hearing loss due to that genetic transfer. And so we do know that one of the most common types of genetic hearing loss is called connexin 26, and that's associated with the GJB2 gene. And there's also associations with a more dominant. So if you had a parent that had hearing loss and then a parent with normal hearing, you could have some type of a dominant genetic transfer from that parent with a hearing loss onto the children. So it is common that we do see children in NICU, in the NICU, or babies that are born that have that are predisposed for genetic hearing loss. Other very notable risk factor that I think a lot of audiologists are familiar with, and Mike, you can jump in to talk about this too. So if we have any type of severe illness, there are some notable illnesses that we tend to see which cause permanent hearing loss, one of them being meningitis. And meningitis causes, it's a bacterial infection that causes systemic inflammation. And that infection can spread to the inner ear, damaging the cochlear hair cells or the inner ear hair cells. And because of this damage, you can have, again, a loss of hair cells, like I talked about earlier, related to aging. In this case, the infection is causing a loss of hair cells, which can lead to hearing loss. And persons that have meningitis or have struggled with meningitis may have a varying degree of sensory neural hearing loss because of the infection. Other illnesses may be related to what we call middle ear component. So for example, there's something, otosclerosis is related to the little bones that are behind your eardrum. They're called ossicles. And you can have a genetic hearing loss due to a hardening of those bones. And so sometimes in those cases, we'll do a surgical replacement of the bones. to be able to improve hearing. Whereas in other cases where you have a permanent hearing loss, like in meningitis, the only option is amplification. There's no surgical fix to a neural hearing loss. And I'll just mention Meniere's disease is also a very common disorder of the inner ear, and it's linked to having something called endolymphatic high drops. But in general, they don't know what the actual cause is for Meniere's, and the symptoms may vary from patient to patient. So some patients will complain of vertigo or spinning sensations, along with ringing in the ears and fluctuating hearing. So these are all very common illnesses that we see in the clinic, and we have patient-specific protocols for how to manage them. And medications, as Amit mentioned before, one of the most commonly prescribed treatments for patients that have cystic fibrosis are aminoglycoside antibiotics. And these antibiotics may have adverse events that produce changes to the inner ear hair cells or to the nerve, which result in hearing damage. There's other medications outside of those antibiotics that can also produce damage that we'll talk about a bit later.
All right. So the reason why we're talking here today is that people with CF have infections in their airway that lead them to require antibiotics during exacerbation. So they're in the hospital or potentially in the hospital as we're, with new treatments, we're seeing really the face of CF change. But people with CF still come into hospital to get antibiotics. And it's mainly due to treat organisms that I'm showing here. This is from a registry report up to 2019. And the top left graph here shows essentially the prevalence of these infections over the years. And you can see that Staph aureus is sort of plateaued and leveled off. But Pseudomonas aeruginosa, though very common, as you can see in the slide below, in those who are older, the prevalence is decreasing over time. And this has a lot to do with the way we're aggressive with treatment early on in childhood and with new acquisition of infection, but also with the changing environment of the lung with these modulators. The one on the right, the slide here, essentially just shows that Pseudomonas is still a big player in that aminoglycosides or medications that really focus on doing a great job treating Pseudomonas are still necessary. And here are just a list of antibiotics that we use. This is just a short list, but just kind of gives you a flavor for the different categories of antibiotics that are there. And we're going to mostly be focusing on aminoglycosides and specifically tobramycin in our conversations here. But I'll also touch on vancomycin, which is a glycopeptide, and other antibiotics and treatments that can really provide risks to your hearing. So aminoglycoside antibiotics are often used to treat severe bacterial infections in persons with CF. They can cause nephrotoxicity, elevation in your liver function tests, and electrolyte disturbances like low sodium, magnesium, potassium. But we monitor and schedule blood work on a regular basis. So this is something that we know about, that we monitor closely. And then there's also neurotoxicity and dermatologic reactions that may be more clinically apparent. But as far as ototoxicity, there is no routine monitoring during admission, and not at many centers. And so there's also infrequent screening. So we don't monitor the change in hearing that might occur when you're exposed to aminoglycosides, and we don't screen people as well. So so that can lead to permanent hearing loss, as Andrea alluded to, and she'll talk more about this. It can cause tinnitus or the noise in your ear or your head, as well as balance issues or vestibular toxicity, which is, a lot of this is not felt to be reversible. So it is really important to prevent it in the first place. And pharmacological adverse reaction affecting the auditory and vestibular end organs of the inner ear, resulting in functional impairment and cellular degeneration, is the definition of ototoxicity. So just a couple quotes before I turn things to Michael again, is that I was taking care of a few patients, and this is just a small example of just the way and hearing loss can be so impactful. But this 21-year-old with CF with a history of Mycobacterium abscessus and who was being exposed to a different type of immunoglycoside called amikacin reflected that I wish I knew this medication was going to hurt my hearing before starting it. Now, being on amikacin certainly extended his life and trying to prevent this infection from taking over his lungs. But one of his biggest joys was to sit in a classroom and to learn. And it was something that he cherished. And having had the difficulty to be able to sit in class and actually learn really impacted him, and something that he exclaimed as we were thinking about another course of amikacin. And another patient of mine who stated, my lungs feel great and the best lung function I've had in over a decade, but I feel alone and isolated. Here's a 33-year-old who was 1 year post lung transplant. And at that time, before he was fitted for a cochlear implant, he was really depressed. If you ask him, he's like, what are you doing? I'm playing golf. And you would assume that, what a great thing. He's really happy playing golf and enjoying life, but he was playing golf alone. And it was because he really couldn't communicate with others. And this really led him into a deep depression. So I'm going to turn things over to Michael, who can give us his personal view, especially as a clinical audiologist.
All right. Thank you. That nice introduction. Hello, everybody. My name is Michael. I'm an audiologist at the University of South Florida. So I'm going to share with you a bit of my background and some story about my experience. So I was diagnosed at birth with cystic fibrosis after two of my brothers. I'm the youngest of five, so it was running in my family already, so they caught it pretty much right away. So as I was growing up with cystic fibrosis, I have used oral antibiotics, primarily zithromycin regularly when needed. So if I ever felt sick or had some sort of upper respiratory infection, I would 99% of the time hop on some oral antibiotics. Sparingly, I would use inhaled tobramycin if it was a certain type of bacteria or something else going on. Luckily, I haven't used that too much, probably 6 or 7 times over the years. In addition to that, I also had colon cancer when I was 13, which was a surprise to everybody, including me. I was on a trip with my family. We were driving to Connecticut to go visit my grandparents. And I was just feeling terrible for 1 or 2 days beforehand. And we didn't know what was going on. And we started finding food particles in my urine. And we knew that wasn't right, so we decided to turn around and go home. So we found out later that after some what was supposed to be minor surgery, that I had a large mass in my colon and that it had eaten through to my bladder. So that's why I was passing food particles. Sorry if that is too much information, but I went through chemotherapy for 9 months. A combination of fluorouracil and oxaliplatin. And I just realized when I was typing up this slide that May of this year marks 15 years of remission after the 9 months of chemo. So that's exciting. Some hobbies, these are noise-related hobbies of mine. I played drums avidly when I was in middle school and in high school and undergrad. And also motorcycles for the last 6 years or so. Thanks, Joan. She said, yay, Michael, on her mission. When I was playing drums, my mom always encouraged me to please, please wear earplugs, but I didn't because I was a kid and I was dumb. So my compromise was putting some toilet paper in my ears and calling it earplugs. So I revised that behavior in college. When I learned more things about my ears, but years and years and years of drumming with hardly any protection at all when I was a child. And when I ride motorcycles, I use earplugs because I only started that in the last couple of years. So something interesting about my story is that I had no idea that people with CF were at risk for hearing loss until I was in graduate school studying hearing. I was in a lecture about ototoxicity, and I saw on a slide, it popped up, you know, populations at risk, and it said people with cystic fibrosis and people who had chemotherapy. And I went, oh no, that's me. So that was a little weird to first learn about that in school. And I first noticed that I had tinnitus because I was studying an exam about tinnitus. And I was studying and I was learning about it. I was like, oh my gosh. And I put some earplugs in because my roommate was being loud. And I heard some ringing in my ears, and I noticed it was louder when I plugged my ears, and I connected the dots and I said, oh my gosh, I have tinnitus. And since then, I just like, I think about it all the time. So sometimes I wish I didn't know what it was. mine sounds like multiple high-pitched tones that are constant. It luckily doesn't bother me during the day, but at night when I'm trying to fall asleep or if I'm wearing earplugs, it can get a bit bothersome. Also in school, we were learning how to test hearing, and we were testing each other. And I noticed that everybody else's hearing thresholds were great and normal, and mine at the end of the range, the high range for the standard hearing test, I had a dip in my threshold, so I couldn't hear those sounds as well. I also, during one of my rotations, I caused my supervisor to think that her machine was broken because we were testing it on me and I didn't have the correct responses that an individual with normal hearing should have. So that I was, you know, connecting every dot to think, huh, maybe there's something wrong with my ears. And we can go to the next slide here. And I think Angie's gonna take over for a little bit and explain some mechanisms of ototoxicity.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks for sharing your story. So I didn't want to go into too much detail about the mechanism, but I think it's important to highlight some of the research that we know. So what you're looking at here is kind of the ascending pathway of the auditory system. So that head picture on the left. And this little shell-like structure is called the cochlea or inner ear. And the inner ear houses your sensory organ of hearing. The little canals attached to the cochlea are called semicircular canals, and they actually house the vestibular organs that are important for balance. So some people actually don't know that your ear does play a big role in balance, not just hearing. And then you'll see that hearing information goes up through the brainstem up to the primary auditory cortex, which is in the temporal lobes here. So one thing to note is that when you do have ototoxicity, it's not just limited to the little shell-like structure called the inner ear. That's where the sensory cells are housed, and those can sometimes be lost from hearing, lost due to the drugs. And so you may have some neural fiber issues up in the brainstem or even further up that we haven't investigated yet. So to the right, this picture in the middle is actually a cross section of the cochlea. And what we're seeing is the organ of Corti, which is your sensory organ of hearing. And so one thing that we do know, if you advance on it, One thing that we do know is that the structure that's responsible for developing the inner ear fluids to maintain balance, to keep the hair cells healthy and the other structures of the inner ear, we think that maybe the immunoglycosides get into the fluid through that structure and then get into the top of the sensory hair cells, where they basically bathe the hair cells in the drug. And that can sit in the hair cells for a long period of time. There's some animal evidence that shows that immunoglycosides, for example, that specific antibiotic like tobramycin, may sit in the cochlea for anywhere from 6 months up to a year. And so we think that the loss of hair cells is due to the entrance of that drug into the actual cochlear cells itself. The reference here is a nice paper that talks a bit more about that mechanism in detail. So it's really important to note if we're going to identify ototoxicity or hearing issues or ototoxicity symptoms like tinnitus or balance issues, we need to have an appropriate way to test for that in the range of the age population. So babies, these are my little twins. We have different techniques and metrics for testing babies versus how we would test toddlers and also how we would test adults. So I'm just briefly in the next slide going to go over the pediatric testing metrics that we have and some of the different techniques that we use for really young babies versus toddlers and older children. So to the left here, you'll see that we talk about from birth to 6 months of age, we use these physiologic tests. They give us information about the hearing system without asking the infant to give us a response. Because if that were to happen, it would take a very long time, if ever. So what we typically do is we record brain waves to sound at different pitches or frequencies. And we get a response called an auditory brainstem test response that gives you a series of waveforms that actually come from the auditory brainstem. And so we know that there are normal levels or sizes of those waveforms for babies of a young age, and that those might vary with older children. And so we account for that when we're doing these newborn or early brainwave tests. We also use something called an otoacoustic emission test, where we put a little probe in the inner part of the canal and we play sounds and record echoes coming back out from the inner ear. Those echoes are a byproduct of the sensory inner ear hair cells, and they tell us about the health of the cochlear hair cells and function. This third test here is called tympanometry. And that's the most commonly used test to make sure that the middle ear or eardrum and the little ear bones, the ossicles behind the eardrum, are working normally. So for example, if you had fluid behind the eardrum, an ear infection, or if you had wax in front of the eardrum, that could create a barrier to getting a good hearing exam or auditory brainstem test. And so we want to make sure that the eardrum is clear and working well before we try to record an otoacoustic emission or a brainwave test to sound in these babies. Once the children get a little bit older, about 6 months of age, we start to do behavioral testing. This is an example of a visual reinforcement audiometry test. And so I'm just going to ask Amit to play the video.
Oh, where did he go? Is he went? Sorry. Oh, there's a piggy. See? Piggy.
So, as you can see in this video, and I just love sharing this because I get the question all the time, how do you test babies? We do a conditioning to where you pair the sound with some type of a fun reinforcer. And so when the baby hears the sound, they're going to link it to that toy or that monkey playing drums. And then eventually, as the tester, you play the sound and you don't give the baby the reinforcer until they actually give you a response to the sound. And that's what's happening in this video. So we tend to use this technique of VRA. Yeah, and we can stop the video. We tend to use this technique regularly for babies 6 months up to about 2.5 years of age. And then we move on to kind of more traditional behavioral testing methods. So this example for the 2.5 to 5 year-olds is condition play audiometry. And what you see here is a little kid wearing headphones, And instead of asking him to raise his hand or press a button when he hears the sound, he's actually playing a game to keep him stimulated. So you'll play a sound and then you ask him to put the toy down. And so we condition the slightly older children to use this technique for responding to different tones that we're playing. And so at this age, we then kind of assess whether they're getting to a point where they can raise their hand or press a button, and that can vary. I've been able to do that with 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, and sometimes, you know, kids up to 7 will still want to play a game if they have to have a hearing test. So the other point I wanted to make here is these are the most commonly used clinical metrics, but there are more efficient tests that we may use for some of these assessments. Like, for example, tympanometry is used clinically, and most clinics use that type of test. But we have another metric called wideband absorbance that gives us a lot of information about how that eardrum and the bones behind the eardrum and the space behind the eardrum is functioning that may be more efficient than just tympanometry itself. So, and then Mike's going to take over and talk a bit about how we test older children and adults.